Relationships Under Construction invites you to attend their annual fundraising banquet on Thursday, April 6th at the Villa Milano. Relationships Under Construction is an international organization headquartered right here in Ohio. Relationships Under Construction teaches middle and high school students healthy relationships based on virtue, not physical intimacy. Help Relationships Under Construction reach more youth with the truth about relationships. To register for the Relationships Under Construction banquet on April 6th, go to relationshipsunderconstruction.com.
We're getting the band back together. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Great to be back with you again, Barry. And once again, 2 weeks in a row, we're in the same studio. Very rare event these days.
Oh, well, you know, it is a little bit rare, but it just so happens on this beautiful day where the temperatures are, you know, still in the cool range, but starting to climb, and we're starting to really feel like spring because it is now spring. We're recording this on Wednesday. I just spent most of my morning sitting in a committee room in the Ohio Senate on a piece of legislation, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But I wanted to spend my afternoon doing something much more enjoyable than sitting around a committee room. And so you and I decided to get together and break bread and actually record some radio. And we're sitting here in your office and looking out at this gorgeous tableau that we have here at Shea Michaelis. And it's just great. And Chuck, because it's Wednesday and people are, this will be somewhat stale news by the time they hear it on Saturday. We've had an incident that's taken place. It's breaking news right now that a terror attack has happened in Britain, in London, near Westminster. The Prime Minister of the UK has been scurried off to an undisclosed location. Parliament has been locked down, and the assailant has been not only detained but dispatched at this point after injuring over 10 people, and probably the numbers will be changed by the time Saturday comes around.
Right.
But he basically drove a vehicle. Surprise, surprise, we're kind of familiar with this, with what happened down at Ohio State a few months ago.
This seems to be the going meme these going days
meme
on how
is
it's done.
Drive a vehicle into a crowd and then go after and try to attack somebody in law enforcement. And this individual, this perpetrator, did just that. They drove a vehicle into a crowd, injured at least 10 fairly critically, and then he jumped out of the vehicle with a knife and stabbed a police officer 3 or 4 times before he was dispatched by, I believe, another officer who did it with extreme prejudice, as they say, Chuck. And it's funny, because you and I were talking about this earlier as we were prepping,
right,
that the British and the international media immediately came out with a description of the potential assailant as being of Asian descent.
Yes.
But then one of the newspapers came out with photos from the scene and photos of the assailant while he was laying on a stretcher being tended to. And Chuck, let me just ask you, did that look like anybody of Asian descent you've ever seen?
Okay, I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt on this because, yes, because most of the Arab world is in Asia.
Well, okay, if you're going to use that broad of a definition for Asian descent,
you
then
and
yes.
You and I got the same impression when we first heard it, and that is we assumed it was East Asia.
Well, yes, of course, because at least in America, maybe it's just because we're isolated over here in the
right.
colonies. When we hear Asian, we think of your Eastern Asian. That would be Japanese, Chinese, Korean,
Indonesian,
etc.
I'll be quite honest. I assumed Indonesian or Burmese or someplace where there's a heavy Muslim population.
Correct.
I'm sorry. I did jump to the conclusion that this was a Muslim attack because this is the way it's been done lately. It's not necessarily jumping to a conclusion. I'm always open to a correction. If this had been a Scandinavian Lapland elk herder or reindeer herder, I would have said, okay, mea culpa.
Who has albinism or something of that nature, yes.
But it wasn't. And
who also still could have been Muslim.
You know,
Muslim is not an ethnicity, it's a religion.
That's right. There are lots of European, Caucasian Muslims. And in fact, speaking of Caucasian Muslims, the Tsarinev brothers, mm-hmm. if you'll recall, they were from Georgia, I think. Mm-hmm. They were Georgian or Ukrainian.
One of the satellite split-offs from the Soviet Union.
And if there's any place where it's Caucasian, it's in Georgia, since that's right smack in the middle of the Caucasus Mountains. So can the wrong impressions be derived? Yes. And am I guilty from time to time? Yes. Can a northern Finnish reindeer herder be Muslim?
Of course, again.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't see why not.
He or she, I should say.
But the chances, if we're talking in a statistical fashion,
yes.
The answer is probably not.
Probably not. Okay, well, we'll probably post up on our website at principledpolicy.com the photos from the Mirror, one of the British newspapers, showing the assailant laying out there with what would be considered classical, stereotypical features of someone of Muslim and not East Asian descent.
Middle Eastern.
Large, heavy black beard, more of the Middle Eastern complexion, larger bodied person.
Yes.
Not exactly what you would consider a stereotype Asian.
Asian, right. I know people get caught in this trap. I once saw a comment on YouTube by somebody who clearly was extremely prejudiced against the Christian faith. Someone had made a comment about Jesus, you know, and his death on the cross. And this person says, well, quit worshiping that white man on the cross. And I laughed and I said, well, Jesus wasn't white. He was an Asian. He was of the Mediterranean sort of, you know, race is a,
he was a Hebrew. Yes. Who spent most of his time in the Levant area and in Egypt. So that part of the area of the world, the average person doesn't come out looking lily white like you and I do.
That's right. They're somewhat darker. They're not as black as Africans. They're not as white as Germans. Let's put it that way. And the bottom line on that is I have a degree in biochemistry, as some of you know who listen to this program. And I've always thought race is not a set thing. There's no hard border lines between races.
Okay. Can we stop right there? Because now you're touching on one of my little raw nerves.
Race, yeah.
The word race.
Right.
Okay? Let's be biblical about this. We are all of one blood, Paul says.
Yep.
There are no such thing as races. That is a falsification. That's the fake news that came out of what Darwin was trying to get across, which was to split us up and create an ethnic barrier to people by considering them of different races. There is no such thing. Our DNAs are all human. We are of one blood, as the scriptures say, and Christ assured us. There is no such thing as there is one race, and that's the human race. Okay,
that's exactly right.
So don't get drawn into this trap of talking about race relations or racism, because that's false flag.
Right, exactly.
To a thinking individual who is biblically informed, we know better.
And judging race is a foolish thing. You basically said in short-winded fashion what I was going to say in long-winded fashion, and that is, there really isn't any such thing as race. If, as you go around the world, people change gradually and subtly into other things, depending on where they live in the world or where their ancestors lived. Now, you can go anywhere pretty much in the world and see people of every ethnic background and origin, basically in with everybody else. You go to London, there are people of East Asian, Asian, African, Caribbean island. There are people
Norwegian,
Indian, from Indian subcontinent, and Pakistan.
And I would have to lay a sizable wager that there are probably some Russians, England.
Ruski.
We seem to know that they're everywhere and they're invading all of our governments.
Yes, that's it. It's the latest boogeyman, folks. You know, I have to laugh because the Russians were a big boogeyman. It's interesting how things come full circle. When I was a kid, the Russians were the boogeyman. The boogeyman, the people who were going to get us. Now,
that's because you grew up in the era of the Cold War like I did.
That's it, man. That's it. I was, let's see, Sputnik was launched when? In 1957 or 59?
59.
I was 2 years old when Sputnik got launched, and everybody panicked.
I was -9 at that point.
I was too. My brother was just born that same year. So it was a major panic, and that's when the space race started and all that. And let's not kid ourselves. The race to get to the moon first really didn't have all that much to do with getting scientists to the moon so they could get some rocks.
No, it was for bragging rights between the two superpowers.
It was actually for developing the ballistic missile technology.
Yes, to launch a missile across continents.
And gaining hegemony in the area of launching satellites. And the bigger the booster you can build, the bigger the satellite you can put into
orbit.
Into an orbit. A fixed Earth orbit, which is, if I remember right, 22,050 miles, geosynchronous orbit. You have to get a satellite out that far. And nowadays, I mean, we're routinely building space stations and that kind of thing. We're talking about missions to Mars and all that. There's really no point to it. There's no point to a mission to Mars unless you want to kill your astronauts.
Well, it's funny you happen to bring that particular point up, because a latest piece of news that came out this week from Washington, D.C. is that there will be more missions to Mars,
yes,
because President Trump, I'm not sure why, but President Trump signed into law an appropriation for NASA to use for the Martian exploration missions of $19.5 billion of taxpayer money. Now, I'm not sure this is exactly what the voters who supported Donald Trump were expecting when they voted him into office, but you and I have talked before about the incredible black holes that are NASA budgets.
Oh, absolutely. And where are they spending tons of money? To force the global warming falsehood down the throats of school kids, and essentially giving people who are begging for money an excuse to ask for more.
Well, okay, Chuck, I think you've just hit on the weakness in their whole plan, because I'm thinking with this administration and with the new director of the EPA, the last thing they would want to do is use the $19.5 billion that they were just granted to go try to push climate change, because it seems like this administration is cleaning a house on climate change advocates within the government and starting to defund all of the pet projects that are continuing to prop up that piece of false science.
Well, okay, but I will tell you that Ivanka seems to be a climate believer.
Yeah, but he's not married to her anymore.
No.
Oh, not Ivana. Okay,
no,
Ivanka,
no,
his daughter.
No,
his
he's
daughter.
Definitely not married to Ivanka.
Well, there were some things that came out during the campaign that people were trying to make
an illicit connection
there. So.
Yeah.
You're right. You're talking about Ivanka, not Ivanka.
That's not even permitted in some very strange cultures that we would consider very strange. No, Ivanka seems to be a true believer, and Ivanka seems to be one of the spark plugs on the whole essentially Obamacare relabeling and switching the burden from the federal government supposedly and switching all the profits over to corporate bigwigs who have essentially forced all the nonprofits out of hospital ownership and have replaced them with corporate ownership of hospitals. If you want to know why you go in for instance, like my wife went in for an anaphylactic reaction, the doctor never even touched her. They told us our bill would be $300, which, since we don't have direct insurance, we paid out of pocket. And we suddenly get a bill for another $1,400 several weeks later. And we say, okay, we paid you what we owed you before we walked out the door. We negotiated a price. Well, we had to up the diagnosis.
Ah, so they're overcoating.
Yes,
okay,
we refused to pay it. And got into a big dispute there. And, of course, what did they do? Something that nonprofits never did. That is, they tried to destroy our credit.
Yes.
And they were successful in damaging our credit, although we've gotten most of it back by now. But this is the kind of thing you can expect more of if the rebranded Obamacare, now branded RyanCare, takes effect. Because, essentially, this is taking the wallet out of the right-hand pocket and placing it in the left-hand pocket.
Well, pretty much, because the right-hand pocket was government, and the left-hand pocket is the big
government-private partnerships, the
medical industrial complex that's out there right now that is benefiting directly from RyanCare. But you know what? We're recording this on Wednesday. Supposedly, they're going to try to vote on Thursday on RyanCare, but it's not looking too healthy, because it looks like the Conservative Freedom Caucus has enough of a solid block of votes that as long as the Democrats don't give them a vote, and it doesn't look like Nancy Pelosi wants to, they're not going to be able to get it out of committee, much less get it passed on the floor of the House of Representatives.
It looks like, my guess is, this bill gets pulled and rebuilt from ground up.
Well, and that probably would be a good thing, because frankly, what needs to be rebuilt is start it with zero funding, and then let's build everything that you can do with zero funding. Does that sound like a good plan? I think I like that plan. People are going to cry and complain about it because they've gotten used to the government gravy train. But you know where the government gravy train leads us, Chuck? It leads us to state legislators moaning and groaning about how bad our financial situation is and why we need to have a new constitutional convention in order to rein in an out-of-control federal spending monster.
Why this is important, because you see how these ideas intermesh. What you're seeing now there's a big push on the Ohio legislature right now, and I'm not going to steal Barry's thunder on this because he's going to give you details that I should be able to give you, but I haven't been able to due to business concerns because I haven't been able to testify, which means I haven't been able to do the research I need to do to testify. But the fact is, there is a big push on in Ohio get the state legislature to issue a call for a constitutional convention. No longer are the calls for single issue items as they have been in the past. If you've listened to our shows and read anything on our website, www.principledpolicy.com, principledpolicy.com, you will know that we have written extensively on this, why a constitutional convention is a bad idea. And what you'll find if you pay attention to the latest calls for a constitutional convention that are going on in the Ohio legislature right now, they are basically confirming everything that we have said all along, and that is constitutional conventions cannot be held to single items. They're held to the items that the delegates have in mind when they go in. So anybody who has decided that they want to eliminate, for instance, the Electoral College, or they want to institute the idea of term limits, and arguably term limits are a terrible idea, and maybe we'll get a chance to explain why. We've explained it on other programs. Basically what it does is it derails people who are great people who are out there fighting for true liberty, and turns power over and puts it over in the hands of the party apparatuses, because all they do is when they don't like you and you kick against the ox goads of the party system, they simply wait you out until your term limited out and replace you. So, and they replace you with a party crony. So, shorthand, that's what's going on. There are all kinds of things going on. And all you had to do, for instance, was this Ryan Care thing. You can really see the fingerprints of the big corporations on this thing. They want to be in control of it. They didn't like the fact that they got squeezed out. The big idea was that was going to be a guaranteed profit for them under Obamacare, and what happened to it?
It almost wrecked half the industry.
It essentially wrecked the healthcare industry all but. And which is why I withdrew long, long, long ago from the insurance fraud,
mm-hmm.
and went over to a cost-sharing plan.
Right, and we'll Christian name it. It's Samaritan Ministries.
Folks, I would recommend Samaritan Ministries highly to you. My wife and I have had to use it in that very situation I just talked about earlier. We did have to turn in a claim for, the $300 we laid out, plus $1,400 or $1,500 more, so it cost us about $1,800. That, you know, and they did cover it once we put in a claim, and they said, "Can we negotiate this down for you?" And I said, "It's too late. We're past the negotiation stage.
Mm-hmm.
They're in collection." So they helped us out fantastically, and you know what? I wish I'd gone to them. Had I realized what was going on, they kind of caught me by surprise with the whole extra bill thing, and Samaritan would have talked it down. Okay, so going back to what we were talking about, there are all kinds of things going on, especially in the with the legislatures and that kind of thing. Constitutional conventions are now the things being discussed again, as we discussed, elimination of the Electoral College, Guaranteed, there will people that will be demanding that healthcare be made a right, that the government has the obligation to provide for. In other words, it will write into the Constitution a welfare program that has never been in there before. Welfare is not permitted. Despite the general welfare clause, I love people that say, doesn't the general welfare clause mean that? No, it doesn't. The general welfare clause means is talking about the general welfare of the states, not of individuals. You have to remember that the federal government is a government of states, not a government of individuals. It's not supposed to touch you, ever. The only time you're really supposed to have anything to do with the federal government is when you get drafted into service and when you go to the post office.
Okay, well, I just did that, so I had my intersection of the week for the federal government.
You didn't
so.
Get drafted, though.
I'm kind of a little bit beyond the age of drafting.
I was
going to
say that they wouldn't want me anymore. Yeah. I'm getting past the militia age. I'm not quite there,
just
but
about.
I'm.
That's
yeah,
right.
The normal militia age was between like 16 and 55.
So,
well,
so you go from the draft to the militia to the Metamucil Corps.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. That's the way it feels sometimes.
Pretty much.
But there are all kinds of things that are being proposed, and let me tell you, folks, there are things that you won't like. If a constitutional convention gets called, there are going to be all kinds of strange things discussed, up to and including a chucking the current document and writing a new one.
Oh, and there are already at least three or four that I'm aware of, complete new constitutions that have been written by various special interests, all of whom have lots of money behind them, Chuck. It's very interesting to note that these aren't like citizen-driven. You know, we want better government than what we've got, and so we're going to, you know, make some just fine-tuned tweaks to the U.S. Constitution to make sure it's much more, solid and very understandable, and there's none of this gray area with all this old language and anything. It isn't like you're just going to, like, update grammar and the usages of capitalization.
No.
In the document. They're going to actually throw off and create another document. Now, I spent pretty much all morning this morning sitting in a committee room as the Senate version of this nightmare, Senate Joint Resolution 1, was brought forward supposedly for a vote today. But and what happened was a number of folks testified in opposition to it, including yours truly for our Policy Institute. And that's the reason why I mentioned at the beginning of the show about getting the band back together, because you know what? It's been too long that you and I have like really kind of hopped in the saddle on this thing and actually rode out to go fight this little beast.
Well, we've tilted at windmills on this thing and basically knocked the windmill over a couple of times.
A few times. So it was kind of fun to get back in the saddle and go back and get the band back together and start getting on the gig again. So we had a great hearing today. I mean, great in the fact that, the proponents, now again, the sponsor of the bill and one of the main co-sponsors, the co-sponsor is the chairman of the committee it's in, and the sponsor of the bill is one of the key people on the committee. And needless to say, both of them were very defensive about their little resolution that they're trying to get passed and couldn't quite get their head around the idea that there are people out there who have grave concerns about this, and that even the founders, when they put this into the Constitution as Article 5 and gave that two-tiered method for amending the document, the Constitution, always believed that the first method of amendment would be the safest and probably the most used route, which is Congress proposing an amendment that they then pass and then they send to the states for ratification. We've done that, Chuck, 18 different times.
Right.
First time with the Bill of Rights and the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, which happened very shortly after the Constitution was ratified.
Well, thinking about it, the first 10 amendments were done the same way.
Yes, that's right. They were done the same way.
So there are really 28.
This is true. So, but you have that, and you have the other 17 or so amendments. Yeah, 17, I believe. That have come into play, and every one of them have been done the same way. It's been by congressional introduction and then ratification within the states. Never even with the founders who put the provision in Article 5, they chose not to use that second provision, which was getting the states to call for an Article 5 constitutional convention, because, as James Madison and others feared, they feared opening the Constitution back up to innovations. They were worried about the fact that if you opened it up again, there would be other forces that would get hold of it, and they would radically change the delicate structure of what they had put together. And they had a right to fear that. And that's the reason why, from 1789 up until now, the only means of amending the Constitution that we've ever used has been the congressional route. But here we have a group of legislators, mainly calling themselves conservatives. They're Chinos. They're conservatives in name only. Basically are sitting there saying, well, we know better than the founders. We've grown so much more, and we're so reasonable, so let us just be the Solons of this. And of course, you know, we, the state legislature, can bind the delegates, and we can tell Congress what we're going to do. Funny thing is, Chuck, part of their argument is Congress is in runaway, they're spending, and the states have no power to stop them. But yet, we're going to pass a piece of paper that's going to bind the Congress in setting up a convention that might actually be able to put a curb on Congress's power and authority. How do you think that's going to work?
Well, it's not going to work at all.
Exactly. It's not. But these people are too blinded to their own sense of self-importance to figure that out.
Yeah, that's the problem. I understand what they're trying to do.
Oh, I do too.
They've been sold a bill of goods by what amounts to they put on the mask of being a protectorate of the people. In fact, they're working I'm going to make a statement for which I'm going to pull a Donald Trump and make a statement for which I have very little evidence, except that there's a lot of money involved that doesn't come out of normal people's pockets, the kind of money that's being spent. That is, the groups like the Convention of States pocket, who seem to have access to bottomless pits of money. You don't get that kind of money from Joe and Mary Smith donations.
No, I mean, yes, you could...
Those are corporate donations.
You could end up having a couple of million dollars, maybe.
Yeah.
Three or four, possibly, from your grassroots, okay?
You don't have enough money to hire 50 state coordinators.
50 state coordinators, plus regional coordinators within each of those states, plus national regional coordinators, plus a national director, have three offices in various parts of the country, and be flying retired legislators like Senator Tom Coburn,
yeah,
and others from state to state to come in to promote what you're trying to do. Chuck, you're right. It doesn't pass the smell test. It's very evident, and again, and I'm glad you said that thing about Donald Trump and tweeting without evidence, because,
yeah,
folks, stay tuned. We got something else that's breaking here.
Heard it by the time it comes around, but we're watching it the day that we record happening.
So we had these testimonies, and It was a painful day, I think, for the proponents of an Article 5 convention, because some key folks came in to testify who knew what they were talking about, and really got down to the end of the day, Chuck. They had this resolution scheduled for a vote out of committee, and most likely would have probably then sent it directly to the floor of the Senate the same day. They couldn't get it out of committee. They didn't have the votes for it. So they basically had to just punt, and it looks like maybe next week there'll be another hearing where they're going to try once again to try to vote it out. Now, the beautiful part about that is that gives us another week to work people just on the committee, because right now I'm counting they don't have the vote secured. And I'm going to do my work, and I know a number of other people are going to do their work, and we're going to try to make sure that they will not be able to count the sufficient votes in order to get a simple majority to pass it out of committee. The House has got a version going as well, and last night on Tuesday night, I was in testifying against that one as well, and I was questioned for a half an hour. Well, after I gave my 5-minute testimony, I took questions for over a half an hour, Chuck. It was funny because as the tones of the questions were coming in, I was doing a nose count, and by my nose count, there's not enough support in the committee to pass their resolution either. So they've got two resolutions in committees that we may very well be able just to basically block down and keep from coming out of committee. And that could be the best thing that could possibly happen. And hopefully these people are, you know, even though they don't want to, when they're hearing what the actual truth is behind the reasons why this is a bad idea, that perhaps this will sink into them somewhere in the deep, dark night of their soul when they're, you know, tossing and turning in their covers and watering their bed with their tears, as it says, that maybe that they'll wake up to an epiphany that, oh my goodness, I've been wrong, and I'm about to throw out the baby and the bathwater and the tub.
Right.
And I won't ever have that back again if I do this.
Well, I'll be quite honest. What I detect is what I always detect on this argument for a Convention of States project, or I mean on a Article 5 Constitution call, and it's the same thing that they accuse us of, and that is the fact that, don't confuse me with facts, I've got my mind made up. Well, the fact is, the reason they haven't been able to change my mind is because I've read all the arguments. They're canned. They have experts sitting around, ask this question, ask this question, ask this. We don't have any experts. We're the experts. We go through and do the research. We go through and fund our own research. I have to buy the books. I have to pay for the downloads. No corporation is pushing me along. No corporation, by the way, one of the things that I'm going to point to here and now is the fact that, if you recall, in Ohio, when we got a gambling amendment to the state constitution, what was contained in that was very important, Barry, was something that had never been done before and is still there and really needs to be changed.
Okay, I'm going to have to think it here a minute. You're talking about the casino amendment.
The casino amendment.
Well, first of all, one of the things that happened was it spelled out specific locations where these things could be located.
That's one.
Okay, so that was one key thing, and they already ran into a problem with that when one of the facilities or one of the locations balked at having it there, and they had to go back and figure out how they were going to fix that without going back for another constitutional amendment. The other one was defined profits. They defined that they were going to make X amount of money.
Well, that's another one.
Okay, so what's yours?
The other one is that they named corporations specifically.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, now, we now have a corporate...
And actually, some of them have already sold the rights.
That's true, because that was the whole idea anyway, was get it through one group, and then they turn around and sell it to the bigger group that couldn't get it because they were not supposed to be able to own more than one within the state.
Didn't Bally sell theirs, I think?
I think somebody did. Harrah's or Bally's. Somebody's, yeah.
But that's the whole point, folks. You're going to see that because corporate interests are behind this, you're going to see corporate interests. We want our corporation specifically named, or if not specifically named, described in such a way that only we can do it.
Yes, exactly.
And
oftentimes that's how legislation is written anyway. It's described in such a way that only a small handful can actually be able to do it. But the key is, though, with the amendment and what you said you're going to see further on, is that when you name a particular entity as being the entity that has this prerogative or this special right, what you've now done is you've turned from a Republican form of government to basically, well, let's just be quite blunt about it, a fascistic form of government.
Yeah, exactly. And fascism not meaning necessarily
Mussolini stomping down the street with hobnail boots.
No. Fascism is an economic system in which government does not own businesses. It controls them through providing capital and labor. They control the capital, they control the labor, and the business owners are allowed a say in how policy gets made.
Especially education policy in the state of Ohio, as you see most of the big business interests pushing for us to realign everything in education in order to address their workforce needs. And that's
right.
The reason why we have silos, we have STEM schools, we have Common Core. Okay, this is a big reason, because the business community, the business roundtable, Manufacturers Association, the Chambers of Commerce, all who are in the can for Common Core are out there pushing education policy. They're wanting the state to align everything with their work goals so that they silo people in so that they get ready-made, already pre-trained workers to go right into their industries. Now, of course, the bigger the industry, the more money they have to give to politicians, the more money they have to give to politicians, the more policy they get shaped their way.
Yeah, and it's a centralization feature. Unfortunately, what's going on, if you'll notice, you know, when I was a kid, my dad was a pharmacist, and most drugstores were family-owned.
Yes.
They were privately owned. Sometimes a pharmacist would own one or two, maybe even three places. Now, then all of a sudden, in the late 60s and early 70s, it started going over to corporate owned. And what you had was regional places. Gray Drug, to name some of the Revco, some of these places that don't exist anymore. Drug Emporium.
Well, that still exists. So
does Drug Emporium still
exist?
Oh
yeah, yeah. I go to one almost regularly near my area. So because they're one of the best places to get organics and natural products.
Yeah,
they have their own section in there for it.
So. Okay, there used to be four or five of them in Columbus. I don't think there are any anymore.
Yeah, I think they pulled out of the Columbus market, but the one that in my market's still going pretty strong.
Yeah. Well, that being the case, when was the last time you saw a Gray Drug?
Not unless you go out west.
Yeah, they've all been bought up by giant corporations, which we're down to really about three:
CVS, Rite Aid,
Walgreens.
That's it. Yeah,
yeah, that's pretty much it. And there's consolidation going on all over the place and that kind of thing. What happens when you have one company and they're directing education policy?
Well, it's a monopsony. That's what it gets down to.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're not just monopolizing. It's basically the monopsony because everything is done in order to suit them.
Yeah.
So and Chuck, it's interesting because our friends over at Third Rail Politics, which is a politics blog that deals with Ohio politics, has got an interesting series going on right now about a certain Senate education chairwoman and her more than cozy relationship, including having family members who work for the organization, with a place called the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, which is the key driver of education policy in Ohio. And they just released, I just saw this morning as I'm going into the State House, they just released a new article with a series of emails that they received that were internal communications between this senator, who happens to chair the Education Committee, and the key policy driver at Fordham Institute, basically going back and forth talking about, okay, is this the policy you want, Fordham? Please tell me which ones we can give to other people and which ones you want me to push. It's there in black and white. I see you pulled it up on your screen.
If this is the one, yeah.
That's the one. Scroll down through it. I mean, it's absolutely breathtaking to see the disdain, number one, that the Senate Education Chairman and this group have for the elected officials in our state and for some of the agency folks. And of course, you know, that if you read down this whole chain of emails, it's, and this is a small piece of, I think it said like 11,000 emails that they got. Or maybe I was wrong in that number.
No, I think that number is correct.
That number is correct. And I think they got that because there's a little thing, there's a lawsuit going on between charter schools and the state over some of the regulations that the state put on charter schools that they couldn't meet. And so a number of them are failing because they can't meet these new regulations. Guess where it's starting to look where these regulations came from? The Thomas B. Fordham Foundation.
Fordham Foundation.
Who have created a division that sponsors charter schools. You starting to see the math here?
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if it's a fact or not, but it's starting to look fishy that maybe Fordham was behind the scenes with influence and money pushing for particular policy changes that would hurt their competition to the point where the competition has to move out of the market, and then Fordham moves in at a discount and takes over, and then they start getting the money from the state. Cozy little arrangement if you can get it
to
it. If you can keep from having an email trail follow you.
Oops.
Yeah, the headline in that article, House members are buffoons, and the Department of Education's a lobbyist, a, quote, snake in the grass, unquote. we're going to put this up on our website. Read this. You can also click through, I think, to other previous articles where this blog has found out that this particular senator – her sister works as a key policy person for one of Fordham's spinoff operations. And she and her sister, she's had her sister in as a policy expert in education, but didn't tell her colleagues or any of the other agencies she worked with that there was a family relationship, which is an ethics issue.
Yeah, it's an ethics violation. And, of course, no one is doing anything about it.
Oh, well, not to this point. But, again, if you have – remember, we're talking about education policy here. There are an awful lot of big players in education policy. Somebody's ox just got gored, and you're probably going to see something happen after it, because what you have now is evidence. You have documentation. Funny thing, remember how earlier you talked about this whole thing about you know going without your having the data and the tweets? Well, that's been an argument at the federal level that the Wall Street Journal decided to take up today with an op-ed piece in the Review and Outlook section called A President's Credibility. Now, the reason when you brought that up, I just read this article, so I'm kind of laughing to myself like this is a perfect segue onto this issue. That basically the Wall Street Journal's editorial, their op-ed, basically is subtitled Trump's Falsehoods Are Eroding Public Trust at Home and Abroad. And let me read to you, again, this is a commentary from the Wall Street Journal. Remember, this is like the conservative business paper of record. Let me read to you the first paragraph or so in this op-ed, okay? If President Trump announces that North Korea launched a missile that landed within 100 miles of Hawaii, would most Americans believe him? Would the rest of the world? We're not sure, which speaks to the damage that Mr. Trump is doing to his presidency with his seemingly endless stream of exaggerations, evidence-free accusations, that's where your quote came in, implausible denials and other falsehoods. The latest example is Mr. Trump's refusal to back off his Saturday morning tweet of 3 weeks ago that he had, quote, found out that Obama had my wires tapped in Trump Tower just before victory on Election Day. The Wall Street Journal editorial goes on to say this. He has offered no evidence for his claim, and a parade of intelligence officials, senior Republicans, and Democrats have since said they've seen no such evidence. Yet, the president clings to his assertion like a drunk to an empty gin bottle, rolling out his press spokesman to make more dubious claims. And you know what? This is a classic example of the rush to be first.
Yep.
And what happens usually in the rush to be first? You end up making some major mistakes. And the Wall Street Journal just made a huge one.
Oh.
Because at the exact same time that this article was hitting the wires this morning, another article was hitting the wires, and you pulled that up here just a second. Devin Nunes, who is the House Intelligence Committee chair, or one of the members of the – no, he is the chairman from California, Devin Nunes, the House Intelligence Committee chairman, just came out today and said, yes, Trump transition members were under surveillance during the Obama administration, right after the election happened. They were being surveilled. They were being tapped. Trump was right.
And that it had nothing to do with Russia.
Exactly. It had nothing to do with Russia. Why don't you go ahead and read some of that's on there, Chuck? I mean, I read that big piece of the Wall Street Journal, and I almost couldn't keep the humor out of my voice doing it. But here it is. Boom. Breaking news. We told you we had more breaking news. Here it is.
Now, Nunes said the monitoring appeared to be done legally as a result of what's called incidental collection. But he said he was concerned because it was not related to the FBI's investigation into Russia's meddling in the election and was widely disseminated across the intelligence community. Isn't this exactly what some of the Republicans on the committee were trying to get at during the hearing?
Absolutely. And funny thing how the director of the FBI, James Comey, came in front of the committee and basically said, no, I can't verify it. None of what he said is true. Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Looks like James Comey might have been lying to Congress.
He might have perjured himself in front of a committee.
okay, this is not the Obama administration. You perjure yourself in front of a committee during this administration? My guess is he's going to be having to find the next metro train that's pointing out of D.C.
Well, okay, maybe. Here's the problem, Barry. The Never Trumpers were jumping on the bandwagon. See, we got him by the tail.
Well, there's of course.
There's nothing he can do. That's what that Wall Street Journal article was all about. We've right. got him.
Oh, yeah. He's like a drunk with a gin bottle. Now, yes. I mean, you talk about doubling down on dumb. That was that little quote in that editorial from the Journal, of course, non-sourced. It just came from the Journal editorial staff. Nobody wanted to put their name on that one. Probably a good thing, too, because you'd hate to have that much egg on one particular face, especially when the chair of the House Intelligence Committee just basically says, hey, y'all, he was right. He was being surveilled.
So it was his team.
Yeah, so basically what we've got going on here is that the fact that it was incidentally collected, but then it was handed around?
Well, how do you think the New York Times knew that he was being surveilled? I mean, what you're talking about now is collusion between the media and the administration to be given classified information that they had no right to have.
Exactly.
So my question now is, when is the New York Times going to be, not just their editorial staff, but their owners going to be subpoenaed to sit in front of Devin Nunes' Intelligence Committee to answer the questions, who gave it to you, and how long did you have it?
Okay, we're going to go back to the 70s on this, and what happened when people reported items where they didn't want to reveal the source. They went to jail. Reporters went to jail rather than reveal the source. I think you might very likely see that again if you can find judges who are willing to actually allow that kind of investigatory action. In other words, judges might very likely say, oh well, we don't want to get into this. This is likely to uncover some national security issues that we don't want to deal with. Okay, that's when you go into a closed door hearing and seal the records. But you don't let people get away with the fact that they got intelligence. They got intelligence that they're not permitted to have, and they got it from an incidental, supposedly. I'll be quite honest, I don't believe that. I think the incidental really means that that's who they were targeting, and the other thing basically popped up as the excuse.
Well, yeah, I can see that. Yeah, I can see that scenario. But you know what really gets down to is just also today, most of the mainstream media on their wires were promoting James Comey as, quote, the most powerful person in Washington now.
Yes.
Because he was standing up to the Trump administration and basically saying the emperor has no pants on, and saying that basically that Donald Trump was lying. Now it's starting to look like that worm has turned significantly.
Yes, yes.
And it looks like maybe the only person who might have been lying, because now they're not cooperating with the House Intelligence Committee, they've gone into bunker mentality, is the FBI and Director James Comey. Funny how power is very fleeting in Washington, D.C. now, isn't it, Chuck?
It's amazing. And here's the thing. What you're going to see from Comey is basically he's going to rope-a-dope from now and as long as he can. Because what he went from was hero to goat,
mm-hmm.
in one report.
Yep, he did.
And you know how is this going to be spun by the spinmeisters over at MSNBC and Counterfeit News Network, or pardon me, CNN? How are they going to spin this? Well, they will find some pivot to spin it on. But the fact is that once again, Trump has shown that he's willing to come out and say things that get him flack at first and turn out to be correct.
Well, and I think that, you know, that's only going to last for so long before the DC establishment starts figuring out that they're getting rope-a-doped. You know, unlike Muhammad Ali's, most of his opponents who never figured it out until they were laying on the canvas.
That's it, yeah.
I think that the DC establishment and the mainstream media, but I'll tell you what, if this little counter jab that just happened is the counter jab that puts the New York Times on the mat, Trump ought to get the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah.
Because, hey, Barack Obama got it for much less. But if you can take that disseminating rag of falsehoods called the New York Times and basically knock their blocks out from under them, which Trump did on multiple occasions,
yes,
with this one tweet. Chuck, I mean, you know how long I've been around politics. You know how long I've been around the political machine and campaigns and all this other fun stuff. I've never seen anything quite like this guy's ability to sucker them in and then put the hammer down on them in a way that they didn't even know it hit them until after they're on the ground. I mean, this is actually fairly, this should be a college level class in how to be, well, really, let's be Machiavellian in your politics, because he really knows what he's doing. I guess it didn't hurt the fact that, you know, it started not making sense that all of a sudden there would be detailed transcripts of conversations, and the only way you could get those detailed transcripts is if you were tapping the phones.
Well, let's talk about that language. That's what Trump's getting gigged on. He tapped my phone. Well, tapped has a specific connotation than,
sure,
that is they went up a pole and put a listening device on it.
Put little clips on the wires.
No, that's,
yeah,
not the way it's done anymore, and it hasn't been done that way for like over 15 years.
Right.
The way they do it is by intercepting electronic communications, period.
Yes.
And it's all communications, emails.
Well, as we found out from the CIA, they can even turn your television and your smartphone,
exactly,
into collection devices.
And they've been able to do that. Like we talked last week, they've been able to do that particularly, you know, in the old days of dial-up phones, they could turn them on.
Oh, well, sure, absolutely. Yeah, I remember you mentioning that about hearing, like, the ring and there's nobody there, but you can't get it to disconnect because,
uh-huh,
somebody's on there.
Somebody's on there recording what you have to say. Yeah, that's a well-known phenomena. So here's what we have, folks. This day, unfortunately, this happened so fast today. Like from the time we went to lunch till the time we finished lunch,
all of this was breaking all at once. I mean,
I knew about the Parliament thing about
3 minutes before you walked in the door to meet me for lunch,
well,
as
no,
I was seeing it too.
I knew it about 45 minutes before.
Okay, because you had access before you.
Because the guy, I was having work done out here, and the guy said, "Did you hear anything about an attack on Parliament?" And I got out my cell phone immediately, and I said, "Well, let's see."
And you said, "No, it's not November the 5th.
That's right. It's not the November the 5th.
It's not Guy Fawkes Day yet.
By the way, I'm reading a great book on that called Gunpowder Treason by Antonia Fraser.
Yes, I read that. That was very good.
It's a very good book. If you want to get it in a kind of a nutshell, you get lost in the characters. So just read it a second time. You should be able to pick it back up. Kind of talks about what happened there and basically how the government used it for its own nefarious purposes, as the government always does. Was there a conspiracy to kill the king? Oh, you bet there was. What did they use it to do? They expanded it into an anti-Catholic pogrom, essentially. They used it for that particular purpose. So, folks, always, just because there's a conspiracy doesn't mean that all the motives that get revealed are the actual motives.
That's true.
And that's something to keep in mind in this thing. What exactly is going on underneath? Well, the fact is somebody is trying to do a political assassination on Trump. I'm not talking about a physical. They
They're
don't
not
need
talking
to.
Physical. They're just talking political.
They're trying to do a political and character assassination on Trump, and so far they're not doing too well.
But you know what? They're also being rope-a-doped in that too, because think about this, Chuck. They're spending so much time focusing on Trump specifically. Who are they forgetting who honestly could give them as many headaches as Trump does if they're successful in getting rid of Trump?
Pence.
Mike Pence, the vice president.
Yeah.
If you noticed, for the last 2 weeks, Mike Pence hasn't hit the media. And there's a reason for that. And I think Trump is making sure that he stays out of the crosshairs, because if they do happen to take Trump down somehow, Pence would be the heir apparent. He would be the person who steps in to fill the role. If Maxine Waters and Elizabeth Warren and Dianne Feinstein and Nancy Pelosi all get their way and they bring impeachment against the president for all this lying he's doing about this stuff about intelligence. Wait a minute. Oh, he's not lying. Oh, wait a minute. He didn't defund Meals on Wheels with his budget proposal.
I love that.
Oh, now this was perfect, Chuck. And this is one of those things of you just got to shake your head because it actually is the exception that proves the rule. When Trump came out with his, what they call their, his lean budget, which is he's defunding an awful lot of programs that have no constitutional authority whatsoever, thank God. One of the programs that everybody glommed onto in the left and the media to try to beat up on Trump and give him a bad day was the Meals on Wheels program, which helps shut in and disabled seniors. They provide hot meals to them that they deliver to their houses. Okay, that's an okay thing. The reason why they were attacking that program specifically, his budget didn't say anything about Meals on Wheels specifically at all. What it did do was it changed the way what's called the Community Development Block Grant, which was a big pot of money that the Obama administration used to direct to liberal causes to help the Organizing for America effort and to build up their political machine. He's restructuring it and changing it and taking away funding from it and giving it directly to the states and state legislatures to do with it what they see fit. It would be up to the state legislatures or the state executives to decide if Meals on Wheels gets money or not, not the federal government. Funny thing was, I Monday morning I opened up my browser, and here's this article sitting there from the Huffington Post, one of the most liberal blogs out there. And the headline read something like this. Meals on Wheels program experiences record donations and volunteer signups since Trump introduced his budget. Because honestly, the big problem was, Chuck, the vast majority of the American citizens had no clue that there was a Meals on Wheels program.
They didn't
have any clue what was going on. And when they found out about it and thought that it was going to lose federal dollars, what'd they do? Did they go storm Washington, D.C. and give them more money? No, they turned around and did it themselves. They opened their wallets. They handed it to this program that they believed in, that they thought was a good idea. They went out to volunteer for it because people are compassionate.
Yes, exactly.
And Trump gets that. And he realized, stop taking away people's money and let them decide where they want to be compassionate.
Yes.
There's been books written about how conservatives are much more compassionate than liberals and give more to causes rather than to programs that are just political animals in disguise.
Okay, you can interpret it any way you want. Colin Kaepernick came out and gave $50,000 to Meals on Wheels.
Hey, you know what? God bless him. Yeah. He gets a lot more money, but then again, he's out of a job
right now.
And he can't find work
feeling.
One NFL owner said, nobody wants to be on the receiving end of Donald Trump's tweets if we hire the guy.
The real reason is the guy has a crappy record.
Oh, he's horrible. He had one good season, and everything else has been just garbage after that.
Yeah.
But then he creates political polarization.
Yeah.
And no owner is going to bring somebody who's that polarizing into a locker room while you're trying to build a team cohesion, and you're also probably negotiating contracts.
Yep. Okay, we're out of time. Now, before we check out, I'm going to remind you, April 6th, 6 p.m. at the Villa Milano. You heard the ad at the beginning of the show. You'll hear an ad at the end of this show. Relationships Under Construction, again, a great cause. If you want to talk about education like we talked about earlier, the right kind of education, folks, and it needs money, and we need you to come to the banquet.
Now, there's a little catch on this banquet. You can come dressed up in medieval attire.
That's
There's
right.
a theme. And I can't wait to see Chuck in his suit of armor.
You're not going to see it. last year they tried to get me to put on a mask, and I didn't do that either. Now, you know what? If you come, they'll have something there for me to put on.
Yes.
I'll put it on.
Hey, and just let us know that you're there from
That's
the
program. Right.
That you heard it from the program.
So. That's right. So, that being the case, again, Villa Milano, April 6th, 6 p.m. Let us know you're coming. We want to put you down for our table. RelationshipsUnderConstruction.com. RelationshipsUnderConstruction.com. to register, or you can contact us here, vicechairman@principledpolicy.com. And now you know what we think. We want to know what you think. Our website, www.principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.
Relationships Under Construction invites you to attend their annual fundraising banquet on Thursday, April 6th at the Villa Milano. Relationships Under Construction is an international organization headquartered right here in Ohio. Relationships Under Construction teaches middle and high school students healthy relationships based on virtue, not physical intimacy. Help Relationships Under Construction reach more youth with the truth about relationships. To register for the Relationships Under Construction banquet on April 6th, go to relationshipsunderconstruction.com.